What's up, everyone? It's Michael Scotto, HoopsHype.com's NBA writer and host of the Hoops Hype podcast. On today's episode, former NBA player Paul Shirley, no relation to Mo, Larry, or Curly, is going to join me to discuss his new book, Ball Boy, and some stories behind the scenes during his playing days at Iowa State with Jamal Tinsley and Marcus Fizer, and during the NBA with the Atlanta Hawks, Chicago Bulls, and Phoenix Suns. Paul, appreciate you hopping on the line for me from the West Coast. How you doing, brother?
I'm okay. I think that's the first time my name's been linked to the Three Stooges. I get a little Laverne and occasionally. Maybe you'll get a little Temple, but never the Three Stooges until now. So thanks for breaking new ground.
Listen, we gotta switch it up. You can't always go for the same puns all the time. But
right, tell that to the people who come up and ask me how tall I am in the grocery store. We need to get them educated on how we can't do the same material all the time.
Well, in fairness, you're a large target. You're 6'10". So yeah, for those who don't know, they have the answer to that. You know, maybe at the end of the podcast, we could tell them how many licks to the center of a Tootsie Roll, who came first, which came first, the chicken or the egg. We'll see as we get into it. But like I said, I appreciate you coming on. You do have a new book out, Ball Boy, as I touched on. And for those who don't know, writing for you isn't a new venture. You've done it during your NBA career when you were with the Suns at ESPN, and you've written for Spanish newspapers as well, and you have published other books. So, one, I was curious for you, how'd you get into writing in the first place? And two, for those who are listening, what can they look forward to in the new book, Ball Boy?
The origin of my writing is mostly loneliness, honestly. As I'm sure your listeners know, there's basketball to be had all over the world, and I was very much a party to that. I played for a few NBA teams, as you mentioned, but a lot of my career was spent in Europe. The first stop in Europe was in Greece. I had gone there after getting cut by the Lakers as quickly as they could cut someone my first year out of school, and started writing journal entries about what was happening in Greece, just because it was something that I had never really known anything about. And so because there was plenty of material from, you know, traveling to Jerusalem or Poland or France, especially for a kid from a small town in Kansas, I had plenty to write about. So each week would send out these missives in email form in kind of an old listserv format, and quickly noticed that if I made them funny, then people would respond and I would feel less alone. So just kept doing that and doing that, built up a little bit of a shtick, and my list grew as people would ask if they could have friends added to the email list. And then, as you mentioned, when I was playing for the Phoenix Suns, which really means I was mostly watching the Phoenix Suns, their website, people asked me if I could write what was at the time this newfangled thing called a blog about being at the end of the bench. And
or the best seat in the house, depending on how you look at it.
Exactly. And so I did that, and it kind of took off. It was sort of, you know, this was the time, I think it's easy for us to forget how quickly the landscape of culture and media consumption has changed. In 2005, when that started, there was no Instagram, there was no Twitter. So people hadn't yet gotten this like fire hose of information on what it was like to be a professional athlete. So I think it came as, I don't know, just like a welcome reprieve from the usual. And it took off a little bit. I got a book deal that came from that. And then, as you also mentioned, kept writing from there, and have found it to be both cathartic and also somewhat reminiscent of basketball, in that I think there's a I actually talk a lot about the power of a flow state, which is really true in sports when we hit that point where we are just kind of lost and in the zone, lost in a good way. And I think that's true for me with writing, where I know that I'm sort of good at it, but I also know there's a long way for me to go. And that seems to be true of most things that that allow us to reach a state of flow where it needs to be challenging, but at the same time, we have some faculty for it. And that is something I found with writing. When it comes to Ball Boy, first of all, I appreciate you asking about it. It's fiction, and that's new to me and new to my audience. So it's a bit of a leap for people. It is very much basketball related. It's about a kid who finds basketball as a way to fit in when his mom moves him from Reseda, California, to a small town in Kansas. But it's also about community and actually a little bit of what I was just talking about, finding the thing that makes you feel special. I'm proud of it, but I also know that fiction is really personal for people, that even for me, I read a lot of novels, but it's pretty rare when one connects. And so I will be heartened if it connects for anybody.
Well, in jumping into fiction, I'm sure your readers are going to enjoy that new taste, something different from you. Obviously a little different, like you touched on, from when you were playing with the Suns and you were talking about real life stuff going on, whether it was your teammates, heck, even cheerleaders, anything like that. Those are some good stories for sure. But, you know, you also touched on too, you had played overseas. And if I remember correctly, Spain, Greece, China, and Russia.
Spain, Greece, and Russia. There was actually, I played for a Chinese team that was headquartered in Los Angeles because they had gotten kicked out of the Chinese league because they had a player named Sun Yue, who I think ended up being drafted by the Lakers, maybe, that one of the two biggest teams in China wanted. And historically, the two big teams would just get to do whatever they want. I think it was the Shanghai Sharks and whatever the Red Army team was. And the owner just said, like, no, I'm not going to just give you this guy. So they kicked that team out of the league. And the owner kept his team together but moved it to California so that they could play in the ABA, which was a minor league at the time. And this team wanted to have two Americans on it to kind of, like, I don't know, teach their guys a little bit about how basketball worked. So it was me and a guy named Fred Vinson, who very dedicated NBA fans might recognize because he played a little bit in from time to time. We were the designated Americans. So it was like playing for a foreign team on American soil and surreal for many reasons, as you can imagine.
Yeah, and Fred Vinson, pretty sure he's coaching in the league.
That makes sense. I mean, half the people I know that played basketball are now coaching in the NBA. It's funny, too. Like, there's a certain I got to play for – I played professionally for 9 years, which is actually a pretty long career. And because of that, I think came across – a lot of guys who were just really decent human beings that were willing to stick it out. So Fred was also on a team with me in Yakima in the CBA. And it takes, like, there's something really bonding about being in these less than desirable circumstances. Like, when you say less than desirable, most people are like, well, I would have given anything to play professional basketball. But let's be honest, playing in the CBA for $700 a week, living in a motel, is not what you want to be doing with your life, especially when the rest of your peers are, like, starting their lives and moving on with friends and jobs and girlfriends and that sort of thing. So anyway, it definitely kind of, it's really a crucible. And so I think the sorts of guys who are willing to deal with that end up being good coaches because they're able to provide that kind of perspective. Another friend of mine from the CBA, Alex Jensen, is now an assistant coach for the Utah Jazz after coaching the Canton Charge of the NBDL for quite a while. And he's another guy who, just because he's kind of been through the battles, I'm sure that built a lot of character and makes him a great coach.
He's well regarded. And, you know, obviously you touched on Fred Vinson as well. I've heard of him as an assistant coach as well. Alex Jensen, I think a guy that down the line could certainly be a name you'll hear for an NBA head coaching job one day, especially given the success of the teams he's been on. You touched on, too, those other places in Spain, Greece, and Russia. And I was curious, which of the three did you enjoy living in the most and playing in?
So I think it maybe is a little bit egotistical when I say this, but I think you could probably corroborate this, that Spain has the second best basketball league in the world. And I feel like I was perfectly suited for the second best basketball league in the world. It was a place where, you know, we were talking flow state earlier. It was a place where I was challenged, but I could also in some ways succeed. That's not to say that I was going to average, you know, 20 a game in Spain, but it felt like the right level, which is an extremely personal opinion, right? Like that doesn't make it more necessarily a better or better experience to watch or anything like that. It's just that for me, it felt like a really perfect fit. Russia felt like pure chaos at all times. And like I might disappear at any moment. So I didn't love it there. I was, in fact, like, I'm pretty sure I just had my heart rate was probably about 100 beats per minute just resting because I was so anxious about how strange everything was. It just, like, you know, there's plenty of stories of being overseas and being in really odd environments. But in Russia, those seem to come at you pretty fast and frenzied. I remember a game pretty vividly where we played on a court that was laid out on top of a hockey rink. And, you know, lots of courts all over the world might sit atop an ice rink, but this was where you could actually, like, the ice was still there and they had just put like rugs over the ice so that you could walk onto the court, which was just sitting on top of the ice. And I think that's a pretty good metaphor for how Russia felt to me at all times. Like, a little unstable, like things might just kind of go awry at any moment. Greece was great, but they didn't pay me very well the time or much at all, and that was frustrating. Again, lucky to get to be paid to play a game, but also you want to have them fulfill their end of the bargain, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you know, it's like your point before when you talk about, well, yeah, I would have played for anything. It's like, yeah, well, that's like a writer that's like a kid out of college being like, well, yeah, I'd write for free. I'd do this. And okay, good luck doing that when you're, you know, a year or two out of college. It's not cute.
I think it is. I mean, it was like, it's tough because there are people, and I run into this when I talk about my college experience, because especially in Iowa, I'm from Kansas, but went to Iowa State. I think there are a lot of people who can't relate to any complaints about the conditions we played under, because to them, college basketball seems like an extension of high school basketball. But just as you said, there is a sacrifice, right? Like you're going to give up something. And as your career goes on, I can remember so well, like maybe my second year out of college, I had played in Greece, but I didn't get paid what I was owed. I come home, I'm living in my parents' basement. I'm 24 now. I'm going to the old high school to shoot around and to work out. And I realized that 24 sounds young, but when you're in Meriden, Kansas, people are kind of like, what are you doing with your life? You're a professional basketball player. We don't know any professional basketball players. That's an insane thing to say. And it does require this level of commitment as well. That means you can't really hedge. It's not like you can also then go get an MBA and hope that one or the other works out. I had to really be willing to give up my 20s to pursue this thing that was, of course, like successful on a marginal level. But it's also true that, like, I definitely didn't make a lot of money playing basketball, which comes as a surprise to people. I taught here in LA for 5 years at a prep school for the police academy. I was teaching creative writing and English. And one day my kids were like, "Hey, Mr. Shirley, like, why are you doing this? Cause you play professional basketball. So you have enough money that you can just like do whatever you want." And I was like, "Nope, that's not the case." And so I asked them like, to kind of take a guess at how much money I made every year that I played. And then finally led on that the answer was I averaged about $80,000 a year for 9 years, which is, you know, better than a lot of jobs, but it's nowhere near what people think. And it's also not nearly enough to retire on. And while I was telling the story, one of the kids was looking at me kind of wide eyed. And I was like, "Well, are you, maybe, does that sound like a lot of money?" And he's like, no, "Mr. Shirley, do you know that a police officer in Los Angeles, their starting salary is $85,000 a year?"
Hey. Kids say the darndest things.
That sort of tells the story right there. Like it is, you know, it's better. It's a more enjoyable experience than maybe being a police officer in Los Angeles. But it's not nearly for a lot of us, for the Fred Vincents and Alex Jensens and me of the world. It's just, it wasn't nearly like what my, you know, grade school teacher in Meriden, Kansas probably thought. He assumed that I was making Shaquille O'Neal money probably.
Well, you know what? Maybe he would be recalibrating that too. I know he's been talking about how much Rudy Gobert makes these days. You know, inflation's a wonderful thing, but you know.
I think like it's also worth thinking about. You can probably relate to this. Like, I don't know that I would want to have been wealthy at age 30 or 35. Like I did have enough money when my career was over that I could survive for 3 or 4 years without having to be super worried. But I also now, even at 43, have this real sense of urgency that I have to figure out the next thing because I don't have a safety net. And that actually hooks you up to being engaged with the world.
I would have took my chances being wealthy. I mean, I don't know if you know, I'm 31 right now. Like people always ask, you know, how you doing and things like that. It's like, I'm cool. You know, am I, going out in a boat right now? No, but I'm cool. I'm chilling. You know, I get a kick out of that and those price comparisons. I mean, and you know, you touched on like going to the gym, you know, to work on your game and whatnot. You know, before you were in the NBA at Iowa State, you guys had a nice group there. You had you, Marcus Fizer, Jamal Tinsley, Kelvin Cato. These were guys that also joined you in the league. Any funny stories or great times you had with them behind the scenes at Iowa State? You know, I don't know if you can reveal any party secrets or whatnot if you'd go to a frat house or anything like that. I don't know if you had a Fab Five, but
Right. Anything right. Yeah. I mean, I think the problem is that, and this is what I ran into when I, when I sold that book to Random House, as a part of that, I got an agent, right? A literary agent, but it also meant that I signed with an agency generally. And that meant that I was connected to the television side of that agency. And at some point a TV agent said, "Hey, why don't you come up with an idea for a TV show?" And I said, "What about a wisecracking 12th man on an NBA team?" And he said, "That's gold. We'll make that." So we actually got to pitch it. And then we got to make a pilot, which is crazy. Like the chances of that are very slim. The pilot was for Fox. We spent $3.6 million of 20th Century Fox's money doing it. And one of the things we ran into was that the tone of my writing was always, "You think it's this way, but it's actually this way." And that was frustrating for the executives at Fox because they wanted it to be a party all the time, right? So there was a scene where we were on the team plane and they were like, "Well, Paul, what do you think about us putting like some, there'll be a bar on the plane and maybe like a model that's like serving cocktails." And I was like, "That's not at all how it is on the plane. After the game, everybody's exhausted. Some people are hurt. You're trying to get as much food as you can and get to the next city before anybody passes out." And I think that's also true of college basketball. There's a little more camaraderie, I think, than in the NBA. But for me, I didn't drink in college. I didn't really go out very much. I dated like two girls the entire time I was in college because, I was also majoring in mechanical engineering. So for me, college was like being in the military. It was, I had a, my first coach there was Tim Floyd, with whom I'm still close, but he left after my sophomore year to coach the Bulls. And so the next coach was a guy named Larry Eustace, who at this point is, it's fairly widely known in college basketball circles, is a bit of a, an unhinged tyrant. And we did not have a lot of fun. It was not a good time. We were really good, but it wasn't by any means enjoyable. My senior year, like midway through the season, we were headed to win the Big 12 for the second year in a row. And I remember telling my mom, like, I'm never going to play basketball after this season's done. Cause I was so burnt out. I was so just worn down by it. I, in my college career, I had three different stress fractures plus another broken foot. It was, it felt, you know, as I look back on that time, it is not a time that I look back on as the best years of my life by any means. Now with that said, it was really formative. I got a lot out of it. I learned a lot about, of course, discipline, but also I was pushed by those guys. Guarding Marcus Fizer every day in practice probably is what allowed me to worm my way into the NBA. He was a lot better than I was. He was a McDonald's All-American and the, what, fourth pick in the NBA draft. Mm-hmm. And I had very little business being on the same court with him, especially when he first got to Iowa State. But he taught me a lot just because I had to throw myself around in the attempt to defend him every day.
You know, you brought up Marcus. I mean, this was a guy that was a fourth overall pick for the Bulls, and you guys ended up crossing paths again in Chicago during mm-hmm. that time. Like, when you look at Marcus's career, I was curious from your perspective, you know, being his college teammate and knowing how talented he was and, you know, the expectations he had coming into the league, it didn't pan out as well mm-hmm. as I think he would have liked and, you know, others thought around the league. Did any reason why you think that might have happened for him after going fourth overall?
So we were talking earlier about the curse of early success in your life, just even financially. I think Marcus suffered from the curse of early basketball prowess. He was so good coming into college and already so far ahead, even just developmentally and physically, that I think that robbed him of the chance to develop kind of a base understanding of how basketball works. One thing you find, especially in the NBA, is there aren't a lot of guys who are just straight up one-on-one, I'm going to go score a basket. There are a few, but they are the best of the best of the best. Most everybody else has to figure out like how the game actually works, which becomes really complicated when it's 82 games a year and there's this arms race of the best coaches against the best coaches. It takes a lot of just processing of like, how does basketball work? And one thing I noticed about guys like Marcus, and this was kind of true of Jamal Tinsley too, they didn't really grow up watching basketball. They grew up playing basketball, but one of the downsides of that is you don't see the game from a kind of bird's eye mentality. You see it from a first person, almost like if you were playing Call of Duty or something. You see it just strictly through the eyes of the protagonist. And I think Marcus really struggled because he didn't really understand how basketball works. He understood how it worked when he had the ball. But I, you know, I still so vividly remember his freshman year, Tim Floyd explaining some play. And he's like, okay, Marcus, you're going to come here and set this screen, and then you're going to roll a basket, and then you're going to look for the ball here. And then he stopped and he looked at Marcus and he's like, oh, you don't know what a screen is, do you? And Marcus shook his head and he's like, yeah, you just, nobody in high school ever taught you how to set a screen because all they did was say, here's the ball and get out of the way. And I think you see that all the time in professional sports. It usually requires like a certain level of humbling, right? Where then a guy has a realization and later in his career actually becomes better because he finally understands that, like, he's got to know how the game works, right?
Yeah, and I mean, you talked about it. It's a lot easier to be such a physically dominant guy, and he wasn't even the only guy on that team. By then, by the time you got to the Bulls, like, he was in his third year, and you also had two other young guys that dominated in high school, and Tyson Chandler and Eddie Curry on that team, who were on that Bulls squad. They went totally different paths.
We forget that Marcus suffered from the worst curse of all, which is that he was short. He's really only about 6'6". And that's just, like, I always laugh because my parents, for example, first went to an NBA game when I was playing in the NBA. And I remember their response afterwards was not anything to do with me. It was more just like, oh my God, everybody is so big and so fast. And so Marcus was, you know, big by the measure of any rational human sized measurement, but he's not very big for the NBA. I mean, I'm 6'9" barefoot. And so I was not really big enough for the NBA. So he really struggled, I think, because, you know, Tyson Chandler's 7'1" and Eddie Curry is 6'11" and Marcus was kind of almost playing the same position they were.
Well, the funniest thing is Marcus was listed as 6'9".
Yeah, that's not true.
You know, they've kind of cracked down on that a lot at the combine as far as those measurements. But that Bulls team also had, you know, just looking back at the roster, that was Scottie Pippen's last season, and he came back and returned. And Jalen Rose was on that team. Like, I mean, you've got a lot of personalities there. Me, even Jamal Crawford was on that team too at the start of his career. I think he was, you know, it was like his third year. What was it like behind the scenes and in the locker room with, I don't know if I want to say a cast of characters, but you got a lot of different personalities in there for sure.
Yeah, that was a really poisonous locker room. And I don't want to speak too out of turn, because when I was in Chicago, that was also the time that I had my kidney and spleen ruptured like 12 days into my time with the Bulls, and then finished out the year with the team, but spent some of that time in a hospital bed, and was afraid I might die. So I'm not, you know, I can't speak to it entirely. However, I do remember that there was even like a pamphlet, like a weekly pamphlet that would circulate in the locker room, written by an anonymous sort of rabble rouser, basically saying like, Scott Skiles doesn't know what he's doing and other guys should be playing and all this shit. It was real, real bad. There was a dude, Eddie Robinson was on that team.
Yes.
And he was, you know, I actually really loved that guy, cause he just didn't care what people thought of him, which is a trait that I aspire to and don't succeed in pulling off. But like, he was not playing cause I think Skiles had said to him, like, if you don't do X, it had something to do with warmups somehow, then I'm benching you. And Eddie Robinson's like, let's see if he'll do it. And he did it. So there was a lot of roiling discontent. I think Kendall Gill was on that team somehow, which was a strange mix. Antonio Davis possibly was on that team.
Wait, for argument's sake, let me just tell you that team real quick, just for your memory. You got Lonnie Baxter, former Maryland star. You got Corey Blunt, Rick Brunson. We talked about Tyson Chandler, Jamal Crawford, Eddie Curry. You said Antonio Davis. Ronald Dupree is now scouting the league. Marcus Fizer, Kendall Gill. Kirk Heinrich, fellow Kansas guy. I mean, I know you went to Iowa State, but being in that Kansas area. Trying to think. Danielle Marshall. Money Mace, Roger Mason, Gennaro Pargo, and then, you know, we touched on Jalen Rose, Pip, Eddie Robinson, and there's one other guy that I'm thinking of. Junkyard Dog, Jerome Williams.
Yeah. Jerome Williams, yeah. It was a collection of humans that was not a basketball team. And that's why it was like, I don't know, worst in the Eastern Conference, and also why I got to play. They were just like, this guy will play hard. Let's throw him in there. because we're tired of watching all these other guys. I remember, like, when I got there, Kirk Heinrich is from Iowa. He's from Sioux City. And so we knew each other, just not growing up exactly, but he was, I think, a couple years younger than I am. So he and Nick Collison went from the state of Iowa to the University of Kansas, following in the footsteps of Rafe LaFrance. And in return, the state of Iowa got from Kansas, me and J.C. Holloway, who's from Mound Ridge, Kansas, who was also at Iowa State, which is a very bad trade for the state of Iowa. They should probably look into whoever set that up. But anyway, so I had known Heinrich for a long time. He was not happy when I got to Chicago because he was buds with Corey Blount, who I think they had to cut to make room for me, mostly just because they needed. It wasn't like Paul Shirley's going to save our basketball team. It was more like, we got to send a message that we're trying to, like, fix things here. So Heinrich was already mad at me for reasons that I did not understand. And I think Jalen Rose may have already been traded by the time I got there, because I don't remember him being around. Scottie Pippen was just watching all the time because he had promised or gotten a promise that he could retire as a Bull. He's in fact the person that, when I was on the plane from Indianapolis, where I had my kidney and spleen ruptured and was bleeding internally, he was the person that I turned to tell him to go get the trainer, because I was afraid I was going to expire on the plane, which I will never forget. Like, being like, oh my God, I'm never going to live this down. If it turns out I just have a bruised rib and I'm up here crying, and I had to get Scottie Pippen to get help for me.
And thankfully that happened, but I could see the peer pressure on that and a little bit of that concern. Yeah. I mean, I had to circle back for a second. So this pamphlet that was going around, like,
yeah,
to this day, you don't know the originator of the infamous pamphlet that was effectively calling out Scott Skiles.
Yeah, I don't think it was a player. I feel like it was a hanger on. So at that time, there was also some war within the Bulls. Like, this is, you talk about some inside baseball type shit, which is maybe exactly what your listeners are here for. But at the time, the Bulls were frustrated with some of their players because they had, like, their own individual trainers working with them. And the Bulls were like, we can't really control, like, what those guys are telling the players. So there was some frustration on the players' behalf of, like, we don't get to bring our own guys in. But also, the team was awful, so people are tired of losing. And I think, you know, one thing I'm always fascinated with in sports in general is the cohesion and how that breaks down within teams, especially as seasons wear on. So people forget that, like, professional sports seasons are entirely too long. And at some point it becomes kind of it's clear that you're not going to win a championship. It's clear that you're not going to the playoffs. It's clear that there's no, like, moral victory left to be had. And it's really easy for guys to just quit, you know? I mean, they're going to still play the game, but they're not really there. Mm-hmm. I think that's I'm really interested in how that works in baseball, because baseball's such a long season. But it even happens in college basketball. My senior year, so my junior year, we were really good, went to the Elite Eight and lost, you know, just by a hair to Michigan State, who went on to win it all. And everybody was like, oh man, they're going to be good again. Marcus Fizer had left, but Tinsley was still there. And we had just generally a good team. And sure enough, we won the Big 12 championship again. We were a number two seed in the tournament again. However, what people didn't know is that we hated each other and were completely ready to be done playing college basketball. And sure enough, we became the fourth number two seed to ever lose in the first round of the NCAA tournament. And so anyway, back to the pamphleteer. I don't know who was writing this pamphlet, but it would circulate as a way to just sort of stir up chaos.
That's called being here in New York, that's called a tabloid newspaper. And, you know, guys, like, it's almost just funny, like, even hearing that. It's almost like, you know, here's, like, the church bulletin. Here you go. Hand it out. Take one home before you go back. I'm thinking, like, you know, in today's NBA, it's like there's a group text between certain guys in a locker room. And, you know, it's like they're all talking nonsense about, you know, whatnot and who's an idiot and this and that. That, especially, you know, when you're talking about a coach. That year, you guys, I mean, technically you had three coaches because Pete Myers coached like two games, but Bill Cartwright started and then it went to Scott Skiles by the end of it. That's just like hilarious. But what a cast of characters. And it's funny you say that because like that team's almost like, you know, ironically, a lot of those guys ended up on the Knicks years down the line. And like everybody would be like, Isaiah Thomas built like all these great teams with talent. Like you had David Lee, Nate Robinson, Jamal Crawford, Eddie Curry, you know, Zach Randolph. And it's like, yeah, well, you ever see like the meme when you throw all the ingredients in the pot and it like bursts on fire on the stove? Like, yeah, there's no balance there. So that locker room was funny. And you had, yeah, you're right.
Like well, you're saying mean, yeah, about, I ran into that a lot with in the entirety of my career. And it taught me so much about management, right? About how it's so important that everybody feels valued and that everybody's kind of on the same page. It also speaks to the sorts of leadership styles that are important. Like I will always say that an NBA coach needs to walk into a locker room and everybody needs to notice that that person has walked into the locker room. That doesn't mean he has to scream or, you know, kick down a chalkboard, but there should be something that is a little different when that guy's in the room. And that could also just be a function of the sorts of players, like certain players may not respond to a certain person. I think that's also true for managing a business or teaching a class, any of those kinds of things, right? Like there has to be something that's slightly different. When I was in Atlanta, that team had Sharif Abdur-Rahim, Jason Terry, Theo Ratliff, which is a pretty good start right there. And they were just god awful. And it was just a mismatch of players somehow, with the coach. Lon Kruger was the head coach when I started that season. And then when I came back, it was Terry Stotts, who I never would have thought actually would be a good basketball coach, but has turned out to have a really serviceable NBA career. So I was wrong there. But it was like I guess this is the thing I was most fortunate to get was this exposure in a kind of Forrest Gumpian way to so many personalities and so many different cultures. From, again, starting with the Los Angeles Lakers, right? My first ever training camp meeting was in Hawaii, going to the night before camp starts. The only goal of the meeting is let's talk about what we're going to call our pursuit of another championship. Because I don't remember if they'd already won two in a row or if they had won just one in a row. But Phil Jackson was like, we can't call it the same thing that the Bulls used to call it. We need to come up with a new name. So like that's the highest level of basketball then compared to playing in the CBA in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where I'm standing across from the place we're going to play the next night. And it's advertising that Def Leppard is going to come to town in 3 weeks, but they've misspelled Def Leppard. And I'm like, how have I sunk this low? But that diversity of experiences, I think, was really formative for sure. It gave me a lot to write about.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you know, you got to do that later on with the Suns, but you did bring up the Hawks. So I might as well ask you on them. Like you touched on Sharif Abdur-Rahim, you know, Theo Ratliff, you had Jason Terry, Jet's a character. I always loved him. I had him here in Brooklyn with the Nets, even though it was a short time. But you also had like Glenn Big Dog Robinson on that team. Like there were some talented guys there, and you had someone who I think is going to be a future NBA head coach within the next couple of years. Darvin Ham was on that team.
Oh, that's right. What a good guy he is. I remember him being just like so kind to me. We had to go get a physical together and he was really thoughtful. Sharif Abdur-Rahim is kind of the same, like such a good guy. Really thoughtful and interesting. I remember, I think I wrote about this at some point, the fact that one time I came upon Sharif Abdur-Rahim opening fan mail, and he would like look at each letter and then he would just put them in the trash. And I was like, dude, what are you doing? Like, those people wrote you a letter and you're going to just throw it away. And he looked and he was like, oh my God, you're right. What has become of me? Which I thought was like so self-reflective compared to most guys that are in the NBA. And then I don't know if he ever answered those notes, but at least he thought about it for a second.
Yeah. I mean, Darvin, you know, I've obviously crossed paths with Darvin from when he was, you know, he's still coaching with the Milwaukee Bucks as an assistant with Coach Bud and Budenholzer. I mean, wonderful human being, no doubt about it. Definitely missed those interactions. I actually spoke to him recently for a story on Kobe Bryant because he coached him in the start of his assistant coaching career from, a memorial thing on him. But any funny – did you have any pamphlets with the Hawks?
No pamphlets in Atlanta. Yeah, it was mostly like for me, that was, I think the best chance I had to make an opening roster at that time, an opening day roster. And it was, you know, this is, I think it's hard sometimes for people to relate the NBA to just a standard career, but it is a lot like everybody's life, right? Like I had had a pretty decent little preseason. And as people may know, in the NBA, at least at that time, and I think this is still true, in training camp, you'll invite more guys than there are slots for just to sort of get to know guys. And maybe they're going to end up like on a minor league team or you'll keep track of them. So it had started to get whittled down from the original 20 invites to now there's like 15 or 16 guys for 14 spots. And most of those spots are guaranteed already to people. But there's always a little bit of hope that you might earn one of those places at the end of the roster. And anyway, it had come down to me and a guy named Antonio Harvey for the last spot on the roster. They were going to keep one of us. And I can remember pretty vividly that my agent said the GM, and I honestly, I can't remember, I think it's Pete Babcock, but I would be remiss if I tried to say that definitively. I think it was the GM wants to keep you, Paul, and somebody else wants to keep Antonio Williams. I'm pretty sure that's his name. Sorry, I'm getting a little lost.
Brandon Williams, maybe? There was Antonio Harvey, and then there was Brandon Williams.
Antonio Harvey, yes, exactly. Antonio Harvey and me. So it's coming down to either Antonio Harvey or me. And then my agent's like, well, in good news, I represent Lon Kruger, right? Which he's not technically supposed to do that. There's like a little technically coach or agents who represent coaches can't represent players. But Keith Glass was my agent, who's a New Jersey guy. Technically, I think his dad was representing him, but whatever. We had an inside to Lon Kruger. The other thing that was happening, though, was Lon Kruger's from Silver Lake, Kansas, and I'm from Meriden, Kansas, and these are towns that are about 15 miles apart. So I remember thinking, I don't expect a lot of favors in basketball because it's very results-based, but can't it just come true this one time that Lon Kruger will just take a shine to the guy from fellow small-town Kansas and let me stay on the Atlanta Hawks? So night before first day of the regular season, last day of training camp, I go to sleep nervous, but also thinking like, well, maybe it'll come through. And then I wake up, go to practice, and I'm like, okay, I made it through practice. This is good. And then Lon Kruger comes over to where I'm shooting free throws. And he's like, hey, Paul, I need to see you in my office. And I'm like, well, maybe he's going to tell me I made the team, but he did not. He cut me that day. And I think the point of that is that that's how life is for everybody, right? Like you're always thinking, am I going to get this job? Am I going to get into this school? It just never stops, not even in the NBA.
You remember anything from that convo that stuck out?
Yeah. I mean, I would always do a good job of being really political and being like, okay, so what do you think I need to work on while on the inside? I was just like, can you just let me go back to my hotel room so I can cry? I remember vividly that when I left training camp with the Hawks, this was amazingly detailed. They had a shot chart for every player for the entirety of training camp, right? So they hand me my shot chart and they're like, hey, it looks like you shoot well from here and not so well from here. Da, 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 da. And they were like, what we'd like though is we'd like to see you just like shoot more, like be more aggressive looking for your shot. And I remember at the time not having the gumption to say this or even have it be fully formed, but I was like, that's wrong. You do not want Paul Shirley shooting more. You want me passing the ball to the guys that you want shooting more. And it was interesting. It's been interesting watching kind of the analytics movement take over, because I think that's what has separated, or it's been a way for people who understand basketball to explain basketball a little bit. Because even I knew just from the way that I functioned within the framework of the Atlanta Hawks, like, I'm not going to be the star here. Like, you don't want me shooting more. You want me figuring out how to get the ball to the guys that you do want shooting more. And I think that was one of the problems with the way teams were constructed, like that Atlanta Hawks team, or maybe that Chicago Bulls team that we're talking about, or your beloved Knicks. They would just get a bunch of guys who all seemed like they could play basketball well in a vacuum, but there wasn't a lot of complementary parts in that stew.
Yeah, that's it's fun. That's a good word, stew, for yeah. Oh, stew for them. But then the other team you had played for too, we didn't get to touch on, was the Suns. And you want to talk about a loaded squad. You know, that team had Joe Johnson, Sean Marion, Steve Nash, Smush Parker, I think, actually briefly was there. Quentin Richardson, you, I threw you in there. And Amari Stoudemire. I got to ask you one. I'm sorry. One quick question before I go to the Suns. You were saying like you didn't think Terry Stotts would be a good head coach, right? I was curious why.
Well, I thought he didn't pass that test that I was talking about of like, you know, that the atmosphere changes when he walks into a room. But I was around him when he took over as the Atlanta Hawks head coach. So I don't know that he had fully formed his coaching personality at that point. So I think my judgment of that was incorrect.
It's all good. I mean, you know, that it's not like I haven't seen a guy come into the draft and think like, oh, he's going to be a bum, and then he turns out all right. It happens to everybody. Mm-hmm. But like we were talking about, though, going back to Phoenix, that team was loaded.
If you think about like what we were just talking about when it comes to teams being built either purposely or by accident to complement one another, I think the truth about that Suns team was that Steve Nash was willing to be the grease that kept the machine running. And you kind of just have to have that. So he could go score sometimes, and a lot of time if necessary, but he didn't have to. He was able to both get the ball to the right guys and also lead, which I think is highly important. One thing that I went to a week-long tryout with the San Antonio Spurs at some point in the middle of their heyday. And I remember talking to, I think R.C. Buford is from Kansas originally. And so we hit it off a little bit on that subject. And I think it was him who told me that the reason the Spurs were good was because their best player was also their best guy. So Tim Duncan, of course, is who we're talking about here. And he's like, that's the reason that you guys were so good in Phoenix, is your best player is your best guy. And if those two things don't match up, you're usually in trouble. And he said, like, we like to think that we're geniuses here, but really it comes down to Tim Duncan. And I think that, you know, you could extend that analogy to Tom Brady, right? So if your best player is also your best guy, and by best guy, I mean like hardest worker or willing to do whatever it takes to win, then you're going to be fine. But if your best player is not one of your best guys, you're going to be in trouble.
You know, it's interesting. When you talked about Nash in that regard, did you expect him and Amari to ever become coaches one day like they are now in Brooklyn?
Well, yeah, I think there's no world where Steve Nash couldn't be a coach. Like, he's so cerebral. He's also a really good communicator. I don't know why Amari Stoudemire is a coach. He has his own quote tattooed on his forearm. I wouldn't put him in charge of anything, but you know, he's got a name, I guess.
Oh man. How was Brian Colangelo was the executive during that time. Obviously this was like pre Twitter stuff and whatnot. What did you think of him, and if there would ever be reported burner accounts?
He seemed a little thin-skinned, I would say. Would that be an appropriate assessment of him, do you think?
Well, I mean, if there were, you know, those the burner accounts, I mean, if the shoe fits. I will say this. Yeah. I will say this. Anytime I've had a conversation with Brian Colangelo, gentleman, nice guy.
Yeah.
And I felt like he won an executive of the year award. So, you know, it's not like the guy didn't know basketball. Obviously, any exec makes decisions that, you know, go one way or the other. But in my experience with him, he was a gentleman. Great guy.
Yeah, he's one of those guys who what we would say in Kansas is that he was raised right, in that he knew all the right things to say, and he was able to like look you in the eye and shake your hand. I think he suffered because his dad was charming without trying to be, and also his dad had, you know, built the Phoenix Suns kind of from the ground up, so it was a lot to try to live up to that. And he seemed to me, again, this is one guy's opinion, he seemed a little unsure of who he exactly was. And I think that was just reflected in the way that he created Twitter burner accounts.
Oh, man. Even like Sean Marion too. I mean, he's come on a few podcasts. I think he was kind of underrated. He would have been amazing in today's NBA, I think, the way he plays.
Yeah. I mean, again, that's another guy that he would get fed up sometimes because he would feel like he was put upon, but he was kind of willing to do whatever it took. And he also, I think he was on at that time. He was on like a 7-year, $15 million a year contract, which is kind of crazy I know now that wouldn't be a lot of money, but that was a lot of money back then. And that's kind of insane considering that you could never just like give him the ball and get out of the way. He was always going to be mostly a glue kind of role player. I mean, he certainly scored enough points and got enough rebounds, but it didn't come in a particularly dominant fashion. So I think it's impressive that someone recognized his value early on.
Jack of all trades, master of none. Maybe would be the phrase. And those versatile guys now, they're definitely in demand. But yeah, you're right. That when you think about how long of a contract that was and things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, this team obviously didn't have any pamphlets. It's funny because I remember talking with Jared Dudley years ago, and you know, we were talking about that Suns team, and you know, I was working on like, you know, about partying and going, a story on like, you know, partying and going into the city and stuff in New York. Mm-hmm. And he was like, yeah, I remember we won one game, Amari and them brought the party bus up the ramp at MSG. And then we went out. Like, I could imagine that group that you had being fun for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think again that it seems like it should be more fun than it actually is. When I was there, it seemed like everybody was their own little corporation. And I can't imagine that has gotten better in the world of the NBA. I think everybody just is so aware of their own personal value. And that, again, I think there are exceptions where you get teams that are really locked in together and are hanging out all the time. That particular makeup of humans, that particular Suns team, didn't exactly have that. It was more like Steve Nash would hang out with Leandro Barbosa and Rex Chapman, and sometimes I would pal along, and sometimes the trainers would come. And then Joe Johnson would go off with his five friends from Arkansas, who were the only people that he spoke to, and do whatever they did. And Sean Marion would kind of go off on his own little weird world. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't quite as, it wasn't the 27 Yankees for sure.
Well, look, even though it was brief and whatnot, it, you know, you going on those contracts where you're doing the 10-day contracts and whatnot, you know, life had to be a little bit of a challenge, but you were able to get some for the rest of the season and have those stories and experiences that you could say you were an NBA player, and even use that in a way as a platform for your writing career, like we talked about with you able to write for ESPN and, you know, even the Spanish papers and, you know, now having another book and this time in the fiction realm with Ball Boy, in a way, I think like it certainly helped you out in that regard.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, I think, like I said, I, at the time, and there are points in my life, dreams I will have, like actual, in a literal sense, dreams where I'm like, wow, maybe I should have been a better basketball player. But all things considered, it was sort of the perfect career because I had so many weird and, I guess, enlightening experiences along the way. Got to meet so many people just from, just almost as a function of being kind of a marginal NBA basketball player. I could never, I finally sort of let go of the NBA thing around the time I was 29, I think. My last training camp was with the Minnesota Timberwolves. And at that point, just sort of settled into like, okay, I'm just going to go overseas now. And there's also a part of me that wonders, like, what if I had just spent my career overseas? Could I have had a magical career there? But I am grateful that I was driven by this idea of like, I have to prove that I can play in the NBA. And even though I was, you know, I think I'm the second worst player rated on NBA 2K7 or something like that. Even though that's true, there is still a little point of pride of attached to the fact that I did make it.
Thanks for hopping on the line, Paul. And don't forget to check out his book, Ball Boy, on Amazon, where it's one click away. I also want to thank everyone for tuning in. If you want to hear more episodes of the Hoopside Podcast with guest appearances from players, coaches, executives, and media members, you can like and subscribe to it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. You can also keep up with my tweets on Twitter, at Mike A. Scotto. Until next time, I'm your host, Michael Scotto, wishing you and yours all the best.